The case is submitted, and we'll hear arguments next in Nix against Whiteside. That, but it isn't important. Well, we'll see.
Oh, that's a Sherman Sterling's good deed for the day.
Yes, it is. For the year.
Mr. Apple, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This interesting case raises questions regarding the proper role of the federal courts in reviewing the conduct of an attorney who is faced with a client whom he has good cause to believe is about to commit perjury at a state court criminal trial. In a nutshell, the Court of Appeals held that admonitions by an attorney violated the right to effective assistance of counsel, the right to testify, and due process of law. I think the best way I can assist the Court this afternoon, first, is a rendition of the facts, because there are significant constitutional factual issues raised by the record that the Court should be informed of. Secondly, I'll dive directly into the merits of this case. The State's position is that where the only effect of admonitions is the exclusion of perjured testimony at trial, it is not a basis for federal habeas corpus reversal of a state court criminal conviction. But secondly, and consistently with the first argument, the State's position is that Strickland v. Washington provides guidance for analyzing the facts in this case, and that first, the facts reveal no error of counsel that is outside the wide range of professionally competent assistance, and second, even if there were such errors, actual prejudice in the sense of substantial likelihood that the jury's verdict would have been affected is not present here. Let's take our voyage through the facts. Whiteside and two companions in the early morning hours approached Calvin Love's small apartment where he was sleeping with his girlfriend. They obtained entry to the apartment, and a heated argument occurred over drugs. Love arose from his bed and was stabbed by by the defendant here, Whiteside. As a result of the stabbing, Whiteside fled, disposed of the knife, but before he could make arrangements to flee to Michigan, he was arrested by police. Calvin Whiteside died shortly thereafter at a Cedar Rapids hospital. Whiteside's conflict with the judicial system began almost immediately. His first appointed attorneys were former prosecutors, and after several sessions meeting with his attorneys, the attorneys approached the state trial court and moved to withdraw, and Whiteside testified that he just didn't want these attorneys. When asked why, he said, well, they're former prosecutors. I don't feel comfortable with them. At that time, he then insisted on the appointment of an attorney by the name of Thomas Kaler. The state trial court would not allow that appointment because Kaler's law partner was already representing one of the companions of Whiteside who was present at the scene of the crime, thereby raising a potential issue of multiple representation. Nonetheless, Whiteside insisted he wanted Kaler to represent him. Finally, Gary Robinson was appointed by the court to represent Whiteside. What this fact shows, what this series of facts show, is that Whiteside knew how to complain about attorneys and was not shy about expressing those views to the courts. Robinson immediately began a zealous defense of Whiteside on the charge of murder. In the 69 days before trial, he met with his client 23 times or more. I think the record demonstrates the very effective character of Robinson's representation. At the beginning of his representation, he met with Whiteside in his jail cell, was presented with a written piece of paper that purported to describe the character of transactions that led to White's death. And in that written statement, the following words appear. He was pulling a pistol from underneath the pillow and bed just prior to the stabbing. And his attorney asked, Did you see the gun? Did you actually see the gun? And the answer was no. But I thought for sure he had a gun. It was also revealed that Whiteside had some assistance in preparing the statement. Consistently throughout the representation, then, Whiteside said that he did not see a gun, but thought that the deceased did have a gun. He thought this because Calvin Love had a reputation for being armed. He thought that because the night of the homicide, he instructed his girlfriend in the heat of the argument to get his piece, which is slang, of course, for a weapon. Robinson conducted an independent investigation to determine if a weapon actually existed. He talked to the three eyewitnesses who were on the scene of the crime, and they did not see a weapon. And there were two police searches, really, of the small apartment. First, there was what has been characterized as a cursory search, and no doubt it was, several minutes after police arrived on the scene. They did not find a gun. The apartment was then padlocked, and about an hour later, the police ID team arrived and searched for a weapon and did not find a gun. With that, Robinson was convinced that, indeed, there was no gun, but that the best defense would be that the defendant reasonably thought that Calvin Love, while he was in his bed, was armed. And that's how the defense proceeded. But about a week before trial, the defendant, in his own words, got nervous about his upcoming defense. And in a question and answer period with his attorney, he stated that he saw something metallic in Love's hands. And with that, the two lawyers who were present, Robinson and an associate, Donna Paulson, stopped him and said, where did this metallic item come from? You haven't told us anything about that before. And in Whiteside's words, and these are important, in Howard Cook's case, there was a gun. If I don't say I saw a gun, I'm dead. With that, his lawyers were shocked, and they issued anti-perjury admonitions. Specifically, the admonitions were, number one, it's not necessary to say that you actually saw a gun to have a defense here. You could present the argument that you reasonably believed a gun was present. The lawyer said they would not allow perjury in the courts of Iowa, that they would seek to withdraw if he insisted upon presenting perjury testimony. If perjury testimony was presented, Robinson told his client he would advise the court of that fact. And finally, and this is interesting, and I'll quote it completely, Robinson told his client, I probably would be allowed to impeach that particular testimony. That's the end of the admonitions. And with that, Robinson instructed his client to think about it. And in the end, Whiteside dropped his assertion that there was something metallic on Love's hands. And indeed, the question and answer periods and later meeting continued, and Whiteside appeared at his criminal trial and testified fully about the events that evening and testified why he thought that indeed Calvin Love had a gun, but under questioning did not say that he actually saw the
Mr.
gun.
Apple, I take it you take the position that under these circumstances the attorney had a duty to challenge his client's proposed false testimony.
Well, I think there's no question.
What standard do you think should be employed to determine when the facts are sufficient to impose such a professional obligation on the lawyer?
Under the Iowa Code of Professional Responsibility, which follows closely the ABA model code, a lawyer cannot knowingly use perjured testimony at trial. And I think it's fair to say.
Does the lawyer have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt or just have a mere suspicion or what?
Well, he must have more than a mere suspicion. Clearly.
And what standard then? What level of certainty must the lawyer have in your view?
I think, once again, a lawyer has to know, and under the model penal code definition, for instance, of what know is, it means a high probability. And I would even accept for argument purposes reasonable doubt. But let me carry this a step further, because I think I see where you're heading. A lawyer, before he or she issues anti-perjury admonitions, probably should know beyond reasonable doubt that his client is preparing to commit perjury. I think the facts clearly bear that out in this case.
Well, Mr.
Nonetheless.
Mr. Apple, let me interrupt just a minute. What is the source of this law that you're talking about, the duty of the lawyer to the standard applied? We have Iowa law before us, and that was the jurisdiction in which this case arose. You've mentioned the model penal code, and apparently you've given us some of your own ideas. Do those really have any relevance?
I think they do. They have relevance for the Sixth Amendment question. And the Sixth Amendment question is, was somehow ineffective assistance of counsel provided here. And the way we analyze Sixth Amendment cases, I think, is presented in Feretta and Herring v. New York. In Feretta, we learned that the Sixth Amendment constitutionalizes in an adversary trial the right to defend oneself. And in Herring v. New York, we learned that elements of the adversary system that are universally accepted and traditional are incorporated within that Sixth Amendment. For instance, the right for summation at the close of evidence, even in a non-jury case. I submit to you that the Sixth Amendment here is not so broad as to cover an extraordinary obligation on the part of a defense attorney to conduct himself in an unethical manner and offer perjured testimony at an upcoming criminal trial at the request of the defendant. That's how it becomes relevant.
Well, but can't we say that without affirmatively adopting some standard from heavens knows where as to what the duties of a lawyer are in this situation?
Bar of the state of Iowa already declared a standard of the professional conduct of lawyers admitted to practice in their courts?
Yes, it has. The Iowa rule, once again, is that a lawyer shall not knowingly use perjured testimony at trial, and that is similar to the historical traditions of the profession. And it's clear, the Iowa Supreme Court held, indeed, that Lawyer Robinson acted in the highest traditions of the legal profession. And it seems to me that because of that long history that's embraced in the Iowa ethical rules, it is indeed an extraordinary proposition and an extension of the right to counsel beyond what has ever been recognized in any of the cases of this court to suggest that the defendant has a right to the unethical assistance of an attorney simply at his request. This court has never held that, nor would it qualify under Feretta and Herring as being something that's universally accepted and part of the adversary system.
One of the elements of inadequate assistance of counsel has got to be some prejudice.
Yes.
Now, the argument for the defendant has to be that his being deprived of perjured testimony is prejudice.
Right.
All you have to do is convince us that that isn't so, and you win your case, don't you?
To start with.
Without all the other arguments.
That's absolutely correct. And I think the Court of Appeals erred in applying what amounted to a per se approach. The Court of Appeals held that under Kyler v. Sullivan, which, as you recall, is that multiple representation case, there was no need to demonstrate any prejudice on the facts. Number one, that was a misapplication of Kyler v. Sullivan. But I think it's clear that there is no justification for a per se rule in this case. In Chronic v. United States, we describe why per se rules are sometimes applied. First, there are some kinds of situations that are so inherently prejudicial that we know that 9 times out of 10, or maybe even 99 out of 100, that there's going to be adverse impact at trial. And the multiple representation setting is a good example, where there are 3 defendants in the same room and there are multiple crimes. It's almost inevitable that there are going to be conflicting interests. And therefore, under Kyler v. Sullivan and Holloway, we take a more restrictive approach to prejudice. But that's not the case here. The alleged conflict of interest, which I submit to you wasn't a conflict of legally recognized interest at least, is not of a character that it inherently taints the truth-finding process that occurred at trial. And secondly, we have a really good record.
Well, it's hard to say that if a court says, sure, he was going to produce, he was going to perjure himself, but nevertheless we're worried about the truth-finding process.
That's
a contradiction in terms.
Surely. It's the ultimate irony, and that's why the state's first position on the merits is that where the only impact on the trial process is exclusion of perjured testimony, that ought not be a basis for reversal.
Even if what the lawyers did might be subject to sanction
that's
under the
correct.
State rules of ethics.
That's entirely correct. Indeed.
Well, then why do we have to argue so much about how the conduct of the counsel?
Would this be a different case if the defendant had faced with the challenge of the lawyer not taken the stand at all, in your view, or is it just the
I think that helps demonstrate, number one, the lack of prejudice in the case. Number two, I think it also shows that this contest of wills between the attorney and his client did not so undermine the attorney-client relationship that it wasn't possible to mount an effective defense.
I guess I didn't hear if you answered my question. Would it be a different case if the defendant had not taken the stand at all?
I think it would be a different case. Nonetheless, I would argue that where a defendant is determined to commit perjury on the stand, the lawyer may refuse to call that individual. So I would say that that even had the lawyer looked at Whiteside and said, you don't take the stand, that would be constitutionally defensible. And, Justice Rehnquist, I want to get back to your question. Absolutely correct. The Supreme Court is not sitting as a state bar committee to decide which possible approach to the perjury dilemma is best. The only reason that this case is here is to determine, of course, what the constitutional boundaries might be.
The Supreme Court of Iowa can't lay down a canon of professional ethics that violates the federal Constitution.
That's conceivable.
Or it can, but it won't prevail on federal habeas.
That's correct. And so what we're looking for here is what the constitutional limitations are, of course. And that's why I discussed the Feretta and Herring approach to the right to counsel. If it had been part of the adversary system that an attorney should put on testimony that he or she knows is false and should argue the case to the jury, which is what the respondent is suggesting here, then perhaps maybe we'd have a right to counsel violation. But the Eighth Circuit's holding is a tremendous extension of right to counsel beyond any case that I'm familiar with.
Is there a separate right of the defendant to be heard, do you think?
I think there.
And is that involved here at all, as opposed to any Sixth Amendment right to counsel?
Yes. The Court of Appeals indicated that there was a right to testify, and that by being put in a position of having to choose between the right to effective assistance of counsel and the right to testify, the lawyer in this case violated both. I think there perhaps is
Doesn't
a right.
Does the right to testify carry with it the right to testify truthfully?
I think that's correct.
So
the Grayson v. United States suggests.
Did it all.
Right.
We don't say in Harris against New York about 10 or a dozen years ago or more that the right to testify does not include the right to testify falsely.
Yes, you did. In Harris v. New York and in Grayson.
In other words, it's the corollary of what Justice Marshall has just suggested.
And indeed, it might be argued that the lawyer's admonition had an effect on the right to testify. Of course it did. But that's what it was specifically designed to do, as do a whole host of other statutes. The perjury statute, for instance, has an effect on the right to testify. It's designed to inhibit people from getting on the stand and testifying falsely.
Well, taking his statements, the respondent's statements at their face value, the lawyer was urging him not to commit a crime.
That's correct.
That he proposed to commit.
That's correct.
Is it basically any different from his saying that I think I'll go out and shoot that witness, the one eyewitness, and the lawyer talks him out of shooting the eyewitness? Fundamentally any different?
I think it is not, because there is no constitutional right to an unethical attorney to present false evidence, and there is no constitutional right to mount the stand and testify falsely, and therefore the so-called conflict of interest that occurred here was a specious one. There was no constitutionally protected interest at stake on the part of Mr. Whiteside here. I think it's clear as well that whatever the proper admonitions might have been in this case, and I know in the Court of Appeals opinion, this business about I probably would be allowed to impeach is discussed at some length. The record shows that Whiteside, when he was at his post-trial hearing on his motion for a new trial, he relied upon the so-called threat to withdraw. He said, the question was posed to him, did you have a conflict with your attorney? Answer, well, I don't know if I'd call it a conflict, but he said something about withdrawing. Well, plainly, under any of the rules of ethics, it's proper, and all the traditional articles, it's proper for an attorney to withdraw in light of a plan of a client to commit perjury. So I think the reliance on the so-called impeachment admonition was improper. And indeed, the impeachment admonition isn't that far off either, because under Iowa law, the intention of a client to commit a future crime is not protected by attorney-client privilege. And under the canons that you've described, Mr. Chief Justice, a lawyer shall not knowingly use perjured evidence, and he is allowed to reveal the intention of his client to commit a crime and the necessary information to prevent that crime. So let me review where we are.
After the lawyer said he would withdraw and so on, did the client then say, I won't do that?
No, he said, well, the lawyer left it. Think about that.
All right.
Think about the admonition.
Well, then he, without any further communication, he put him on the stand?
No. He came back, and they went through questions and answers again. The record is not clear as to what occurred on those subsequent meetings.
But suppose the client then had gotten on the stand, and
right.
he, and in the course of his examination, he said he saw something in his hand. Well, the lawyer could have cured it all if he thought he was going to commit perjury by getting out of the case, or at least trying to get out. But if he gets surprised, may he then say, may I approach the bench and say to the judge, this fellow's lying?
Yes.
You think he could do that?
Yes. And with what result?
And you think that he, as a lawyer, would be permitted to go on the stand and testify to, and impeach him? Eh?
The result that would likely happen is a mistrial in that setting, Justice White. But, of course, once again, that is not the situation that we're facing. The lawyer may well have an ethical obligation at that stage of the game to call a halt to this proceeding. Now, maybe it would require a new trial. Could be, if it was highly prejudicial, and as well it might be. But there's at least one case, United States v. Campbell, out of the Ninth Circuit, where an attorney in the view of the jury indicated reservations about the truth and veracity of his client's testimony.
If all the lawyer had said, unless you agree not to do that, I'm going to withdraw.
Right. The only
you don't know what the client would have done then. He probably would have said, well, go ahead and withdraw, George. I mean,
well, the verdict.
Get another lawyer.
Well, no.
And I won't tell him the truth, ever.
I don't think there's a problem in
But the lawyer said more than that. He said, if you do, I'm going to tell the judge and testify against you.
That's not what he said. He said that he was going to inform the court and might be allowed to impeach that particular testimony.
Well, he said he'd be willing to impeach it.
He probably would be allowed to impeach it, exactly.
Well, I know, but he said he'd be willing to.
That could be implied from that statement from the record. But even so. At the post-trial hearing on his motion for a new trial, where the petitioner carries the burden, did you have a conflict with counsel? Well, I don't know if it was a conflict. It might have been something, well, I think he was going to withdraw. There appears to be no reliance on that so-called impeachment admonition at all. But indeed, isn't this an open and shut case when the only effect of a lawyer's admonition is the exclusion of perjured testimony? This isn't the kind of case where habeas corpus relief should be granted.
May I ask you kind of a preliminary question? As I understand it, the relief was granted on a Sixth Amendment theory of ineffective assistance of counsel. Is that correct?
Yes, that was part of it, though it was also
at least,
right.
At least part of the whole.
Yes, it was.
Was any Sixth Amendment claim ever made to the state court before as part of the exhaustion of state remedies?
Right. Not by that label. The claim was that the attorney improperly coerced his client into changing his testimony. And the
sort
federal
court.
Sort of
a due process claim, wasn't it?
Well, it was the due process, but it was also that the attorney acted improperly. The lower federal courts, as you know, ruled that the Sixth Amendment claim was exhausted.
But you're satisfied with that ruling. That's really what
I'm satisfied with that ruling.
Okay.
I don't think it would have been any different if he'd gone back to the Iowa Supreme Court and recast it. Let's review where we are. What are the four important aspects of the factual record? Number one, I think it's a very strong record in terms of intent to testify falsely. In Howard Cook's case, there was a gun. If I don't say I saw a gun, I'm dead. Second, this is not the kind of case where the fact finder or the jury learns about the lawyer's reservations about the client's testimony. The judge and jury were not advised. Third, the defendant actually did take the stand, and he had his say in court. And fourth, I haven't gotten to this fact, after the close of evidence, the state trial court asked him if he was satisfied with the representation of his counsel. And once again, this brings me back to my earlier discussion of how he fought the system of appointment of counsel. He said, yes, I'm satisfied. And then the jury came back with guilty on second-degree murder, and then he was dissatisfied.
Well, I don't know whether that doesn't raise a question in my mind. Why would you ask a question like that? Would there be a suspicion that he hadn't acted properly?
No, I think that was a conservative approach of a...
Well, what provoked it?
The record doesn't indicate. I can speculate.
Okay.
think maybe the trial judge was making a record?
Once again, there is no violation of effective assistance of counsel here because the activities of counsel did not fall outside the broad band of professionally competent counsel. Nor was this, is this a case where a per se approach like Kyler v. Sullivan should be applied. This is not inherently damaging to the fact-finding process. Indeed, why do we hold criminal trials? The reason why we have trials is to counter that human tendency, the judge and the familiar, that which is not yet fully known. And that's what the Powell v. Alabama is all about, the guiding hand of counsel. Why? Because the next sentence reads, without it, though he be not guilty, he runs the risk of conviction because he does not know how to establish his innocence. And it's hard for me to see the Eighth Circuit decision as anything other than a topsy-turvy approach to these constitutional rights. One final aspect of the record that I think we do need to discuss about, and it might be a troublesome one for the state, so let's get it clear right now. At the discussion between the court and Whiteside over who would be appointed ultimately as his counsel, when Gary Robinson was appointed, the court said that your chances of another change in attorneys is about zero. Okay? That was after the change from his first attorneys and the insistence on Thomas Kaler, who had a conflict of interest. Finally, he got an attorney, and the trial and the judges looked down and said, your chances of another change in attorney are about zero. Does that mean that the admonitions went combined, the admonitions of counsel went combined with this trial court warning? Does that mean that indeed the choice for the defendant was to proceed pro se if Robinson ultimately withdrew? Might be. But what I want to close with is that where a defendant insists on committing perjury at trial, it would be constitutionally proper to require him to proceed pro se. There would be no problem with that with appropriate Feretta-style warnings. Of course, that is not right because, once again, the witness did mount the stand and did testify fully. I think I'll reserve, unless there are further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Grady.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I think in light of what was discussed here previously in Mr. Apple's opening statement, that it's important to emphasize what was the limited holding of the majority of the Court of Appeals in this case, and that is whatever counsel's duties may or may not be when they're confronted with a client who insists on testifying to what that attorney believes will be false information, that attorney cannot disclose or threaten to disclose to the fact finder his or her disbelief in the client and the fact that the client is lying. And that's what the attorney threatened to do here. That's what puts counsel and defendant at odds, and that is why the Court of Appeals was correct in applying the presumptive level of prejudice in this particular case, because there was a complete deprivation of counsel. And that is why this Court should affirm the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Now, another reason which would allow this Court to affirm
the Court of Appeals would put all cases in one bag. It wouldn't make any difference what the evidence was with respect to whether the client was going to tell a falsehood on the stand. I mean, as the case comes to us, I take it the Court of Appeals decided, even if it's perfectly clear that, and no one would doubt that the client planned to commit perjury, even so, the lawyer may not threaten him with anything that would keep him from saying that.
I don't believe that's what the Court of Appeals was saying. The limited portion of their holding is simply that an attorney cannot threaten or actually disclose.
Even if, no matter what the degree of certainty that the client is going to commit perjury.
That is the holding of the Court of Appeals, yes.
Yes, exactly.
As
the case comes to us, that's the given, that the client was going to commit perjury.
That is how the Court of Appeals assumed it. Now, we are not conceding that the Court of Appeals was even correct in reaching that.
But that's the way it comes to us.
That's correct. Uh-huh. And the problem with this is not necessarily just limited to the situation as it arose here, simply right before trial, but this goes all the way back to the initial interview that an attorney might have with a particular client, where that attorney as is normal, is going to guarantee that client confidentiality and the fact that confidentiality will not be breached, and that for an attorney and the lower federal cases that have
Let me follow up on a question the Chief Justice asked your opponent. Supposing the client had told the lawyer that he was going to kill a witness, a prosecuting witness, and the lawyer said to him, if you do, I will tell the judge what you've done, and I will withdraw. Now, would that be unethical?
That's a wholly different matter. And the reason
Is it different? That's the question.
The reason for that is that the purpose of the attorney-client privilege, as set out in this Court's cases, for example, Upjohn and Fisher, indicates that for the defendant to be able to give the lawyer the defendant's version of what happened is necessary for the attorney to be able to advise the client to develop a strategy of the defense and to actually intelligently exercise the client's option whether or not to take the stand.
Yes, but I'm assuming a case in which the client has given his version of what happened and then having given the version says, yes, but I'm going to testify differently. And what I testify to will be false. I'm assuming an easy case where we know he's testifying falsely.
Well,
then why is it different?
Okay. It's still different from the situation with the witness because having the client or having the attorney-client privilege remain inviolate and having the attorney still give his guiding hand to the client is part of the traditional adversarial system. Nothing in terms of bribing jurors or threatening witnesses has ever been recognized as part of the adversary system in this country or any other country that I know of. And that is an important...
Has perjury ever been recognized as part of the adversary system?
No, it hasn't. In fact, as was brought up in an earlier question, it's clear, and we are not urging, and the Eighth Circuit is not urging, that there is certainly not a constitutional right to perjure oneself. The question is, however, is what enforcement mechanism is necessary in light of the impairment on the attorney-client privilege that this would bring out that is proper to balance both of those interests.
Well, but I wonder how much of an impairment there is at all. There are certainly cases from this court, an opinion of Justice Cardozo's back in the 30s, I think, that said not only is potential criminal conduct not protected by the confidentiality, but even a scheme to commit fraud is not protected.
Well, again, that's why in cases such as Harris, of course, the defendant can be cross-examined by prior inconsistent statements. A perjury prosecution is proper. And, of course, the judge can enhance a sentence if, in fact, the judge believes that the client is going – or, the defendant is going to perjure or has perjured himself.
Well, in this particular case, when your client said, I'm going to perjure myself, what redress do you think the lawyer should take?
Okay, well, a few facts. If I might ask, is it are you giving me a hypothetical or
– I don't need any facts for my question.
Okay.
I'd like to get an answer to it.
Okay, the answer you can give, and this is what the first thing that an attorney must do in that particular situation, and that is an attorney must give the – start out telling the client first basically just the strategic or even moral reasons why it's not proper or advisable to testify to the version the defendant wants to give. For example, he could point to other facets in the record which would contradict the defendant. They could point to the fact, again, of a potential perjury prosecution or, again, point to the enhanced sentencing. There are plenty of things an attorney might do in that situation, and the record doesn't reflect that the attorney in this case, in fact, did those things.
And it didn't say that he did not, did it?
Well,
it's just silent on it.
Well, I think the record...
Well, we'll take a hypothetical.
Okay.
The witness says, I'm going to perjure myself, and I'm going to say that I saw a gun.
Okay.
What can the lawyer do? What can he do, and what should he do?
Okay. Again, as I stated earlier, the attorney first must try to dissuade the client by using basically practical, strategic reasons to try to talk the client out of perjuring himself.
So.
Okay. At that point, and again, this depends on at what stage in the proceeding this would particularly happen, if it's the day before trial or several months before trial. Now, may the comp-
or during the trial.
Or during the trial. And that makes a difference because, again, as I think the Deputy Attorney General indicated, during trial,
At the same time as there is in this trial.
Okay, which would be shortly before trial?
Right.
Okay, at that particular point, the attorney, if he cannot dissuade the client, there the options that have been spelled out either allow the attorney to attempt to withdraw, which again, and what this does, and this is the only way that this makes sense, is one has to look at the implications of that that goes back to the overall attorney-client privilege, in the sense that the attorney to withdraw.
I'm still asking what he could do. You said he could withdraw.
Right.
Now, what else could he do? Okay.
Well, if I might explain what the problem with the withdrawal method is, that at that point, if another attorney is appointed, then the client's simply going to tell the attorney the last story.
What else could an attorney do other than to withdraw?
Okay. Another option that's been recommended is the fact that the client would have to testify by narrative. That way the client would be able to put the story on, but that the attorney would not have a conflict and that the attorney would not be assisting in the alleged perjured testimony. The criticism of that particular method is
Did the attorney stop him from testifying there?
In this particular case?
Yeah.
He did not prevent him from taking the stand.
So what else could the attorney have done other than what he did?
Well, the attorney could have first started out with attempting to talk the client out of it through lesser methods. What the attorney did in this particular case is jump all the way to the end of the spectrum, which...
Didn't they have 23 meetings?
Something like that.
Well, I mean, they did a lot of discussing.
They did.
But you want more discussion.
Certainly, this particular fact situation demands more discussion.
Well,
this particular whatever conflict arises, it does demand
more
discussion.
Do you by any chance say that the attorney should have just sat there and let him go ahead and not said anything about it?
There is a point where if it is impracticable to withdraw, I suppose the attorney can go and try to get the trial judge to let him out of the case. Then if the trial judge doesn't let him, it's just such a complete...
If he let him perjure himself, he'd been subject to disbarment.
Well, I think that
wouldn't he?
I don't believe so.
Well, what is your code? Don't you have a code of ethics in Iowa that says if you knowingly produce perjured testimony, you're disbarred?
That is in the Code of Professional Responsibility, yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I said that. Wouldn't that happen in this case?
Well, if, again, consistent with the Sixth Amendment attorney-client privilege, if the attorney goes ahead and allows that testimony, I think under Manis versus Myers, that the attorney would probably be protected in the long run.
He wouldn't be disbarred?
In the long run,
he
would be protected.
I suggest you not try it.
Pardon me?
I suggest you not try it.
Well, I mean,
I don't know of anything worse for a lawyer to do than to produce perjured testimony. Because he's suborning it, and that's a crime, to suborn perjury. Isn't it in Iowa?
Well, suborning perjury as it's defined in Iowa would be for the attorney first to either encourage or pay someone to actually perjure himself, as suborning perjury is defined in the Iowa Code. Now, and I think there is a distinction which has been made that there is a difference between the attorney suggesting to the client how best to get around particular difficult facts and the fact of letting the client testify himself to those particular facts. And that's a distinction, I think, that has to be made.
Mr. Grady, how did the action of the lawyer here, whether or not it met in all respects the Iowa Code of Professional Responsibility, how did that conduct undermine the fairness and reliability of the trial, in your view?
What it particularly did, and this is why I think the Eighth Circuit's treating it as a presumptive prejudice issue is appropriate, is the fact that the jury system, to produce a reliable result, the jury system allows someone with the assistance of counsel, of course, to be able to testify as to their particular facts of the
events. Well, doesn't encouraging a client to testify truthfully enhance the reliability of the trial?
There's no question about that. The question is how far is the attorney allowed to go to get that result?
If the only effect is to, in fact, have a trial based on truthful testimony, How is that in any sense a violation of any constitutional requirement to achieve a fair trial?
Well, again, as the so-called conflict of interest analysis goes, what a court simply looks to in that particular situation is the fact that the relationship was changed because of what the attorney saw as conflicting duties. An actual prejudice standard is not appropriate in this circumstance because of the effect that this particular instance had on the whole attorney-client relationship, just like in a multiple representation case. And therefore,
both on the conviction, if the conviction's been accurately and truthfully arrived at.
Well, it's, again, the same as
accurately and truthfully because there wasn't any perjured testimony in the trial.
Well, again, based on that assumption, again, that...
Well, that's the way the case comes to us.
Okay. But, again, I think that there are other interests involved here, and that's where, for example...
By policing the defense bar.
Well, I think in that...
teaching the defense bar how to act. Why should it really involve setting convictions aside?
Well, because
unless there's some prejudice.
Well, essentially, because of the actual the client is entitled to conflict-free counsel, as this court has held in other cases, and in the conflict of interest context, the court doesn't weigh whether or not a just result was obtained.
Do you argue that there is some right to testify falsely on the part of, not the lawyer now, on the part of the defendant, a witness, that there's some right to testify falsely if it'll help you?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. That's why, if there was a right...
Well, then at most, all the lawyer did here, if it had any impact, was to dissuade him from committing perjury.
Well, again, I think there's two facets to your question. First, there is not a right to testify falsely. If there was a right to testify falsely, then, of course, the defendant could not be held to a higher sentence if there was a right to testify
falsely. We have at least three cases where we've addressed
right.
that.
Waldorf, so that's not what we're urging.
Havens and Harris against New York.
Right. And because of those cases, it's clear there is no right to testify falsely, but that is
then
not what
right
we're
is, what
here.
Right is it that you're urging on us?
We are urging the right, well, we're basically urging the right of the client to rely on the attorney-client privilege and prevent from disclosure.
Well, there was no disclosure here by the lawyer.
There was threatened disclosure, and there really is no significant difference
well,
in that.
Well, then let's take that other harsher case. He said he was going to go out and kill or persuade somebody to kill the principal witness. Would you say that that is a different kind of a felony from committing perjury or suborning perjury?
I think in the context of the attorney-client privilege, it certainly is a much larger difference, again, in light of the adversary proceeding.
Well, what about, let's make it gentler then. He's going to bribe a witness.
No difference. It's in the sense of it's the same as...
Is that somewhere between suborning perjury and murder?
Well, it falls into the same category as going out and doing harm to a witness.
Aren't they all in the same category?
I don't believe so, and that's because of the impact on the attorney-client privilege as it relates to the adversary system. And that's where the disclosure of the particular perjured testimony goes all the way back to anyone's initial interview.
Well, why is the conflict different from the in the case where which the Chief Justice has put to you than in the case we have before us? In each case, the lawyer urges the client not to do something, which is unlawful. The client apparently goes ahead and says, I'm going to do it anyway. And then the lawyer says, all right, I'm going to impeach you or I'm going to advise the judge. Isn't there's just as great as conflict where the client has talked about bribing a witness or killing a witness as there is in the case where he says he's going to commit perjury, isn't there?
Well, again,
Can't you answer that yes or no?
My answer to that is no, it is not the same situation.
Why not?
Okay, and the reason for that being, again, the right of the defendant, again, going back to the initial interview all the way through trial, to be able to fully give all information, good or bad, to the attorney so that the attorney can advise the defendant as to
why does that distinguish those three cases from one from another?
Those three
hypotheticals? The two hypotheticals from the present.
Because the client's actually talking to the attorney regarding the client's involvement as to this continuing representation is something that's been accepted over time as part of the adversary system.
Well, but you're
and these other matters have not.
You're simply, that may satisfy you as an answer. It's just utterly unconvincing to me as to why the three shouldn't be treated the same way for conflicts of interest purposes.
They were joint defendants, co-defendants. They each had separate lawyers. Each of them told his lawyer privately, I'm going to commit perjury. The one lawyer says, oh, don't do that. You may be, it's just a bad thing to do. It's the wrong thing to do, and you may be indicted for perjury. That's all he says. And the guy says, well, I guess I better not. And the other fellow does what this lawyer did.
What's the difference?
And so the fellow says, I guess I better not. And in both cases, he's deprived of a chance to commit perjury. But you draw a distinction between the two.
There is a very large distinction, again, in terms of the threat to the attorney-client privilege. The first set of admonitions that was given is done consistently with an attorney and a client basically still sharing the same interests, and just like any other type of advice as to why a particular...
Yeah, but why should all this, even if you're right about the lawyer's conduct, again, why should this have a consequence for the conviction?
Again, because it is the defendant's right in that sense that was...
His right is not his right certainly wasn't to try to mislead the jury by perjured testimony.
That's correct, and we're not arguing that. His right was to have an attorney dedicated to the preservation of the attorney-client privilege.
Well, couldn't your client have complained to the judge that the lawyer interfered with him or threatened him?
At the point when
Yes, couldn't he have gone to the judge and said, Judge, my lawyer has threatened me by having me charged with perjury? Why couldn't he have done that?
I suppose theoretically he could have. I think part of the reason behind that is... Well, certainly he didn't want... I mean, part of the reason that the threat worked is he didn't want the trial judge to know of the particular problem.
Right.
In fact, that's what the attorney testified to.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, I think the point here is that there are certain interests within the adversary system that this court, for example, in the Portash case, this court held that someone could not be impeached with immunized sworn testimony when that defendant wanted to get up and give testimony which was different from that. Now, obviously, the court was finding in that case that the truth-seeking function was subservient to, for example, one's right against self-incrimination.
As I understand your position, the heart of your argument is there's a conflict between the lawyer and the client, that they have a different – the lawyer is not pursuing the client's interest. But what if the lawyer thinks that perjury would be a tactical mistake and more likely to result in conviction than if he told the truth? And therefore, everything he did was justified by his interest in acquitting the client. How do you find a conflict of interest then?
Because I think essentially in the Curtis Court in the Seventh Circuit recognized this, that the tactical reasons for trying to talk a client out of either testifying or what's testified to is still a decision of the client himself, because the right to testify, or the decision to testify at least, is a personal right.
Well, the decision
right
to testify, but in the fact pattern we have, where he's going to testify, it's just a question of what he's going to say, and the lawyer sincerely and effectively urges him to tell the truth because he thinks it's going to be more persuasive than by introducing a falsehood into the story and maybe looking very bad on the witness stand.
Well, that's,
wouldn't that be in the client's best interest?
Certainly that would be, but when it gets to the point
Well, then
that
where's the conflict?
The conflict is reached at the point where the client does not theoretically, and again, in this case, we don't have the record to support that the attorney tried those methods, that the client won't acquiesce. And at that point, when the attorney again then is going to threaten to violate the attorney-client privilege, that's when the conflict arises. The conflict wouldn't have arisen until that point if the attorney was simply trying tactical methods to talk a client out of giving what he believed to be false testimony. And again, in this particular case, the lower courts did not apply a standard which was proper to even make that determination, which the Eighth Circuit assumed that, in fact, this particular client was going to testify falsely, based on the fact that simply the good cause standard was applied or a compelling support standard applied, when really a reasonable doubt is the proper standard in the sense that the attorney as an advocate must apply at least as high a standard as a jury, who are not partisans, to determine whether or not a defendant is lying.
The Eighth Circuit accepted a fact finding against you on that point, didn't it?
That's correct. Now, the Eighth Circuit believed that they were precluded by Sumner versus Mata from making a different fact finding. And the case law indicates that they did not have to do that under 2254 because of the standards under which an attorney has to make that particular conclusion is really, at the very least, a mixed question of law and fact, because besides just historical fact, the attorney has to apply, again, the canon of ethics. He has to apply the fact that any doubts must be resolved in favor of the client, and the fact that just that someone might give contradictory statements is clearly not enough.
Well, did you urge that as an alternative ground for affirmance in your brief?
Yes, I did. That was the initial few paragraphs before I treated it as if there was a presumption. In fact, there was going to be false testimony there, and that is a real key here because an improper evidentiary standard was used. And again, I think it's important when one looks at this case, however distasteful, of course, to everyone, the aspect of client testifying falsely is the fact that any rule that might come out of this case is going to affect how an attorney is going to address his or her client in the initial client interview. That if the attorney cannot tell the client that what the client tells the attorney cannot be told to anyone else, then in fact the attorney is not going to have the benefit of full disclosure to be able, in fact, number one, dissuade the client if in fact there is some type of false testimony coming up. Number two, being able simply to give the guiding hand of counsel that is required by the Sixth Amendment.
Well, in your view of this initial interview where the attorney tells the client that he can fully disclose because none of it will ever be breached, does the attorney have to go ahead and mention the instances which are exceptions to the confidentiality, where there's a threat of committing fraud, where there's a threat of committing crime?
Well, in terms of for one thing, I think it's very difficult to just tell a client regarding what, you know, fraud or perjury. You have to explain things in a little more detail, a little more plainly. But the fact is that how an attorney in honesty would have to explain that would deter a client from being absolutely honest, because the client probably isn't going to know what is and what isn't going to work against
him. So you don't tell the client the actual state of what the law is respecting the confidentiality of the lawyer-client. You give kind of a gloss to it to indicate it's a lot more sweeping than it is?
Well, that, I think, is current practice among the defense bar. Now, if, in fact, you give exceptions to the attorney-client privilege and try to explain them in the initial interview, that's going to deter the client from giving full information to the attorney.
Mr. Grady, it would help me if you would summarize exactly what you think the lawyer should have done in this case.
In this particular case, the lawyer, under these facts, should have first tried to dissuade the client.
But he did that. He did that. The lawyer tried to dissuade his client.
Well,
what else should he
have done? My reading of the record indicates that the attorney jumped straight to the threat to disclose without going through those other steps of explaining to the client what exactly would be in store for him in terms of potential perjury, prosecution, cross-examination, and enhanced punishment.
And should the lawyer have permitted him to go ahead and testify falsely?
At that point, I think the attorney, at that point, if all else fails and withdrawal is totally impractical, I think that at that point we have to rely on the adversary system to seek out the truth, and that they're going to disbelieve the client, and the client is going to pay the ultimate price.
You think counsel should have permitted the defendant to testify? That's what CA8 said.
That's basically it.
Yes.
Well, I don't think, again, I don't think that the Eighth Circuit necessarily said that. Their limited holding
was
that.
Well, if you look at page 20, page A9, I think you'll find it did say that. And Judge Gibson thought the Court of Appeals said
the dissent, that is how the dissent characterized it. Again, the narrow holding of the Eighth Circuit.
What do you think? I understood you to say you thought the lawyer finally, after trying to dissuade him, should have permitted the defendant
to testify.
At that
point, the attorney had the system requires that then, at that point, the jury make the decision, and that the faith has been placed in the jury is that the jury is going to find the client out, and the client's going to pay the price.
The answer to my question is the lawyer should have permitted the defendant to testify and kept his mouth shut.
Had all those other steps in the meantime been?
Can he at least say, try to talk him out of it? Then he say, and if you still insist, I'm going to withdraw.
The attorney could say, yes, I can attempt to withdraw.
Yes.
Now,
he
again,
can say that, he can go that far.
I would agree that he could go that
far. And then if he talks him out of it using that threat, you wouldn't be here. That wouldn't be.
I think there's, well, assuming he went through the intermediate steps,
yes.
I would agree. I would agree. But all that basically does is it means the attorney has to go to the judge and the judge has to let the attorney out.
Suppose he testifies falsely and he's acquitted. May the lawyer then say he committed perjury?
I would say not, again, because the attorney-client privilege would extend beyond that.
Then isn't he concealing perjury?
Well, again, as to the impact of the attorney-client privilege,
well,
that's where that exception has to be made.
The attorney-client relationship is terminated at that point after the verdict.
Well, but confidences of a client are not terminated at the time an employment with the attorney ends.
Let's take the other extreme then, the one that Justice Stevens and I were putting to you. Suppose he actually killed one of the major witnesses against him, carried that out. Would the lawyer be required to conceal that?
I don't believe so, because that's not within the scope
felonies.
Of that initial representation.
They're both felonies, aren't they?
And they're both done to get himself off.
That's correct. But again, as how it affects the attorney-client relationship is what makes the difference between those particular cases.
What would you say if right before the defense rests, the defendant then said to his lawyer, I'm going to testify thus and so, and he immediately gets up and walks on the stand to testify falsely. At that point, in this hypothetical, the defense counsel gets up and says, if the court please, or goes to the bench, rather, not in the hearing of the jury, I am bound under the ethical standards of the profession to ask the court immediately to let me withdraw from this case. The judge is likely to say, why? I am unwilling to disclose the reason, but the reason has to do with the testimony the defendant is about to give. Well, that tells the judge,
right?
Doesn't it? Could he do that?
In terms of, I don't believe he can disclose that to the judge.
What does he disclose?
There's a point, I suppose, where you have to draw the line as to what's going to disclose to the judge what the problem is. But again, what that does is throws the problem in the judge's lap.
Well, but the jury still is not informed.
Right, and again that makes it less egregious. But again, of course, the judge may be the one that sentences the client down the road. So that still is problematic.
Very well. Do you have anything further, counsel?
Just briefly, Justice O'Connor, I wanted to come back to the question that you raised in the middle of my argument that I perhaps didn't have an opportunity to respond to fully. And you were asking the question about what kind of standards ought to be applied. And in my view, under the Iowa rules, once again, the lawyer has to know about the proposed use of perjury testimony, okay? The initial judgment is that for the lawyer to make, much as any other tactical decision that an attorney comes upon in the course of representation. A reviewing court, then, in reviewing the lawyer's conduct, should use the deferential standards that are in Washington v. Strickland. Did the lawyer's decision to issue the admonitions in that case fall within the broad range of professionally competent counsel? And even though I get the drift of this court that maybe because the second prong of Strickland hasn't been satisfied in this case, you may not reach the first question of ineffective assistance, that's the proper approach.
Wouldn't you think this is a relatively rare case where a lawyer, where there's that, where the
where the defendant just says, I'm going to commit perjury, and it's so clear because you would concede that the lawyer may not, if there's a real doubt about
That's
the
correct.
Truth of the thing, you wouldn't be here at all.
It's a relatively rare case. The case books have some instances where a lawyer has an alibi or a client presents an alibi testimony to his lawyer, and then at trial he says, oh, no, the crime didn't happen this way, it happened that way, and kind of demonstrates that he was actually there. There are a few cases like that. But where it's mere conjecture, mere speculation, that is, of course, not this case.
Even if the lawyer is himself completely convinced that the story his client is telling is false.
We don't have a disagreement.
No.
The bottom line here is that the problem that the defendant had was not that he had a less than zealous attorney, it's that the prosecution had an airtight case, and that is not ground for reversal of a conviction.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.